So I got a great bumper there from Beck, who was the subject of a news story a couple weeks ago. Leah Remini had come out, and she was, I don't know, outing, attacking, challenging, one of those people who had been deeply in Scientology, even recruiting for Scientology, but were now coming out and saying, well, I read some of the material, but I was never really a Scientologist. And she was saying, you know, this sort of, there's been this shift in Hollywood since both her TV series that was focused on that on A&E and the HBO documentary Going Clear made it more difficult for somebody to stand by an organization which does what it does. Long before Leah Remini was doing, and Beck was one of the people that she was calling out, there are several other rock stars, artists, who were equivocating on their years in Scientology, and she was just saying, hey, you can't have it both ways, because her life has been miserable since having left the church, or at least they attempted to make it miserable. Long before Leah Remini, though, we were hearing about this from Mark Headley, too. Mark Headley's book, Blown for Good, was featured on Coast to Coast about a decade ago, and he and I have kind of stayed in touch. And it was time, I think, to have him back on, because we keep hearing about how perhaps like a, maybe like a cornered animal or something, the Church of Scientology is still lashing out at the people that used to be in it and making threats for the people who are celebrities that want to leave it. So we'll get to that update, and you'll hear his story coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You know, I should probably be more careful about how I phrase things, although I think I spoke in fairly broad terms, because the Church of Scientology is notoriously litigious, and I've been considered a suppressive for a very long time. I'm not on the good list, and yet at the same time, I'm just trying to call it the way it certainly appears in the newspaper articles and in the electronic media about the Church of Scientology. When I say that they've been accused of coming after people, and I said cornered like a caged animal, because it seems like the tide has turned on the Church of Scientology in terms of a popular acceptance that it's just like any other kind of religion. But one of the first people that made that clear was Mark Headley, author of Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. So, Mark, I'll ask you at the beginning, did I say anything did I overspeak at all in that introduction you heard?
No, that was pretty accurate. I think that usually if you're just a member and you kind of did a few courses and you just leave and go your own way, you might get mail or phone calls for the rest of your life, but they certainly don't try to track you down or send private investigators after you.
That brings us to what is fair game. What does that mean then for somebody like you?
So basically, the most of the people that are getting fair game are people that have worked for Scientology. So in my case, I worked at the international headquarters of Scientology from 1990 to 2005. So you see everything that goes on. You see how all of the different organizations are managed. You see David Miscavige, who's the head of Scientology. He's the chairman of the board, Religious Technology Center. And he basically micromanaged every single possible aspect of all of Scientology from his highest position of the church. And that included beating up on people, full-time vulgar language, torture routines, all sorts of craziness. And the people that were at the base are the people that witnessed that sort of thing. And when you get down into the lower organizations, like if you went to Cincinnati or Kentucky or, you know, any of these other outlier organizations, you wouldn't necessarily see that sort of thing. So when people escaped or try to escape from the international headquarters, when you escape It's called a blow, an unauthorized departure. And a lot of times through the 15 years that I was there, I would see people escape and get recaptured. And I knew one guy, I think he escaped 5 separate times. And he was recovered. So they'd send people out to the airports, bus stations, relatives' houses, anywhere that they had any record of that person maybe having a connection to, they would send teams out, and it was called the blow drill. And they would literally hunt these people down, and in most cases, they'd get them back. When I escaped in January of 2005, I did so with the help of the local law enforcement, and that is really the only reason that I was able to make a successful escape attempt.
It's a great opening chapter of the book. It really is. Yeah. And it was kind
really,
of...
If, yeah. When that happened, basically they ran me off the road on a motorcycle, and I ran into the middle of the road and waved.
The security did, not the police. The security for...
The security...
For Scientology.
From the Scientology security force ran me off the road. And when I got into the middle of the road and started waving my hands to someone to help me, somebody driving by called 911. And that person was my guardian angel. I don't believe if that person would have, if they wouldn't have called 911, I think I'd still be there to this day.
Well, and we'll tell the story.
Scientology compound.
We'll talk about what happened with your wife a little bit later, but I think that's a very interesting way to approach this again, because you went through that to get out, and this premise that you spent 15 years, you were working, and then they start with the anti-Mark Headley campaign.
Yes.
Which if anybody wants to Google it, just go on, type in Mark Headley. That's Mark with a C, Headley like you'd expect, and then like Headley Lamar.
Yes.
And you type that in, and you'll see both that they come after you in video and in print about who you were, and that you weren't anybody, and that you are a criminal, and there's all sorts of stuff, right?
Yeah, in the ex-Scientology community, we call those hate sites or stalker sites. And in probably every person from the international headquarters that escaped and lived to tell the story and didn't take a payoff to be quiet, every single one of those people has hate sites.
Yeah.
And for a while, I mean, I only have 10 hate sites. That's not a lot. Leah.
I got more than that.
as soon as Leah Remini started speaking out, they put up sites on her. And I think the last I checked, she had, well, and also this is domains. So these are the domain names that Scientology has registered with all sorts of different wordings and spellings and everything else. But Leah had 88 web domains that were sponsored and run by Scientology that basically said she's a liar and she doesn't know what she's talking about. And she's
so they do that to they game the algorithms for the search engines by doing that. By the more
and
the,
all of the sites, all most of them. I think last time I checked, I think there was 1,800 sites that they or 1,800 domains that they had registered. That they all connect to each other. You know, the craziest part is that Ron Miscavige, who's David Miscavige's father, has 522 domains, web domains registered on him alone.
Hmm.
Because he spoke out. His father, David Miscavige's father, left and talked about how he escaped and how he was able to basically make it into the real world. And he wrote a book about it. And he appeared on the Aftermath Scientology and the Aftermath show. And they've got 522 web domains that are all set up to smear him.
Didn't you tell me a story? Didn't you DM me or emails or something about how his dad, Ron Miscavige, David Miscavige's father, and you at least in part connected because you were on Coast to Coast. Isn't that where he heard you talking about this?
Oh, my God. This is that's true. I never,
remember? You told me the story, and I was tripping.
So this is the craziest thing. The Scientology headquarters, it's out in the middle of the desert. It's out past Hemet and San Jacinto. It's actually its own little city called Gilman Hot Springs, California. And you can't get any radio stations out there. One of the only stations that you can really get, and even it kind of goes in and out, is KFI, and that's AM 640 in
LA.
In Los Angeles. And their transmitter is powerful enough to make it all the way out there.
At night.
And it was actually Coast to Coast was a show that I used to listen to at the base. And other, there were, I didn't know this, but there were other people that were listening to it as well. And when Ron Miscavige escaped, and once you escape and you do anything, we talk to each other, we get a hold of each other, we track each other down. And he said that he and his wife had listened to the Coast to Coast interview that I did.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know what? Mark's telling the truth. This place is crazy.
Ah!
And they got in big trouble for that.
For
and
listening
a whole bunch
to
of
Coast?
People were investigated. And they weren't, it was basically like, you're not allowed to listen to Coast to Coast. No one was allowed to listen to Coast to Coast anymore.
Oh, God.
Because they were fine, because I was on Coast to Coast.
I love that.
All this horrible stuff was going down at the base. And him and his wife ended up leaving. And there was another guy as well. It was a guy that worked for David Miscavige. And David Miscavige had given him an iPhone. And because he had an iPhone, he could get internet. Because most people can't get on the internet there.
Oh, God.
Well, David Miscavige had given Ron a Kindle, and Ron could listen to like iHeartRadio or whatever local stations on his Kindle. That's how he heard it. And another guy that David Miscavige had given a phone, or he had an iPhone or something, and he also listened to the Coast to Coast interview, and he also ended up escaping.
That's awesome. And that was like 2010? Is that what was it? Or before that? Did we do it twice?
It was 2011, I think, is when we did the second. We did one in 2009, and we did one in 2011.
That's right. Yeah. So I'll tell you, this is like, so during like Going Clear or like the Leah Remini thing, I've mentioned that little connection to my kids so often that they just roll their eyes. And I'm like, I played the smallest part in this little thing. Like, we know, Dad. Yeah, shut up, Dad. I already heard that story, Dad. But it was so interesting.
But that's a huge deal that Ron Miscavige, the leader's father, would leave and say yes, all of these things. Because even when I wrote my book, in 2009, there were no TV shows. There weren't 50 Scientology books. There was nothing.
No.
And they said Scientology, we got like drips and drabs from various places. Like his book is patently false, and he's just trumping up things and this and all these other sort of things. And over the past decade, the musical chairs, there's a chapter in my book on musical chairs where the leader basically plays this torture game of, every single person who doesn't get a chair and ends up kicked out of the musical chairs game is going to get sent off to all these far-flung places and separated from their spouses and their families. And basically, only one person ends up being able to stay and work for him.
It's amazing.
That one chapter became a whole part of the Going Clear.
Yeah, it did.
There was a talk about David Miscavige throwing, in my book, I talk about how he was throwing people in, making people walk the plank in a pool at the property there, and how we would get thrown overboard into this mucky, like muck-filled lake that had dead animals and all sorts of other things in this drill that was basically called overboarding, which L. Ron Hubbard himself wrote the policy on this, and David Miscavige would practice it. And they said that never happened. And then eventually the Tampa Bay Times down in Florida did a whole investigation, and they brought up this thing of people being thrown in the lakes and thrown in the pools, and they admitted that David Miscavige did do that, and that it was under the category of ecclesiastical justice. And so basically, over a period of a decade, they pretty much admitted, or it was exposed by so many other people, the things that I wrote about in the book, that they just became, yes, that is happening. It does happen. It did happen. And they tried to blame it, Scientology officials tried to blame it on other officials that had also escaped.
Right. Rogue and, officials that we got rid of.
Yeah, exactly. And the problem with that was that it happened. We found out from people that escaped and then appeared on Leah's show that it was still happening years and years and years after those people had escaped. Mm. So it's basically it's insane. And this is the crazy part. What they do after you leave is even crazier than what they did when we were there.
All right, now hang on to that thought. Hang on to that thought for a second, because I want to make sure we have enough time for that coming up, and we're coming to the bottom of the hour. And I wanted to, believe me, we'll get to that. I wanted to point out, though, too, that as part of how you're discredited is they talk about you as essentially, is it like a thief? Like they talk about like money you owed because they bill you. When you left, they sent you a bill for $150,000 worth of classes?
Yes.
You get, and course material.
It's called a freeloader bill.
Right.
And they basically say you need to pay for all your on-the-job training that you did throughout and any Scientology counseling or any of these other things that you did. And essentially, even that is illegal. You can't charge somebody for training that your employer requires you to do.
Right.
Part of your post function or your job function.
Right. That went out in the days of early coal mining and stuff where they had the company stores and these people just got deeper and deeper into debt. But there was also the fact that they weren't, what was your best year in all the years that you worked for the church? What was your best income year?
I don't know about it. There probably wasn't any one year that was as amazing, but I'll tell you, we worked 16 hours a day was the bare minimum, a 16-hour day. We got to work at 8, and we got off at midnight, and that was on a good day. And there's also travel time in there and going to and from the house and all that other good stuff, or apartment or the birthing, wherever we lived. So I worked a minimum of 100 hours a week. For 15 years with no weeks off. No, you didn't get a week off. Maybe you got a day off of here. When I got my Social Security statement after I left, I made a total of $29,000 for all of the 15 years that I worked there.
That's incredible. And you wouldn't even get Christmases off sometimes because
sometimes we would get half the day or some of the day on Thanksgiving. It was all out on Thanksgiving. Instead of a 15-minute meal break, we'd sometimes get a 45-minute or an hour meal break for Thanksgiving.
Right.
So we really yucked it up on the holidays. But some people, I did a bunch of different things there, but I was mainly doing audiovisual, manufacturing, post-production, film production. And they say that, if you do, I think it's Malcolm Gladwell made it popular in a book. If you do like 10,000 hours or something, you become an expert. I spent about 86,000 hours on so pretty good in that department right now.
Yeah, I think you are. I don't know, when you go to a university, you should show them all of that and say, how many credit hours do I get for this if I were going for a degree?
Some credits for that. It's funny, you joke about the wages though. In my first 3 months after I escaped, I made more money in that 3 months than I did in 29 years.
Yeah.
I mean, in the $29,000 for that 15 years.
$29,000 in the 15 years.
So in 3 months, I made more than I made in 15 years. So it's pretty crazy.
We'll put a pin in that right there, and then we'll get back to where we were headed, which is what happens afterward. Then we'll get an update on you and your wife. But I think that very exciting escape that you put at the beginning of the book is bookended so perfectly by what happened to your wife, for that matter, because it really makes the point. So the book, again, Mark Headley's book is Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. And then also coming up in that last hour, we'll get to your calls, too, for Mark on the way on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So there was a story that was circulating for a while that Sonny Bono was trying to leave the Church of Scientology, or was saying that he wasn't, and they were saying he was. I don't know. It's, when it comes to celebrities, there's just this thing, this sort of fixation that the Church of Scientology seems to have. And it's a love-hate thing. They love them when they're there, and they hate them when they leave. And that's part of what we're getting an update on from Mark Headley, the author of Blown for Good, one of the first books that came out and really sort of laid out what the whole thing was all about. Since then, plenty of documentaries and TV shows have been dedicated to this. And actually, even Mark Headley doesn't know, it occurred to me, the full story of one of his previous appearances on Coast to Coast. So I'll tell him and you about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So actually, let's start with the Sonny Bono thing. I was curious whether, because I know in the book you mentioned how many kids you knew who were the sons and daughters of Scientologists as you were growing up, because you were in these Scientology magnet schools, and you knew a lot of these kids who later on become celebrities, some of whom stayed with the church.
Funny that you mentioned Beck earlier, because I used to go over to his house. He lived across the street from me. His dad actually lived at what's now the Celebrity Center, which was the Manor Hotel, the Chateau Elysee.
Not a coincidence that I did that. I did that on purpose, because you mentioned him.
His wife that he just divorced, he, by the way, said he is not a Scientologist under no certain terms.
Well, he said that now, but that's why Leah Remini was calling him out, called him the P-word, and she went at him. I mean.
Yeah. Well, his wife was my first girlfriend, but they're now getting divorced, probably because she's still in Scientology, and he's saying that he's not. So.
Yeah.
When we were at the Ant base, and it's funny that you say that, because I'm pretty sure that at that time, when I first got to the Ant base, Sonny was a senator, I want to say, or something.
Sonny Bono was, he was a congressman.
Congressman, and he represented our district.
Oh, interesting.
The Ant headquarters. And so when things needed to happen, they would call their congressman, Sonny Bono. And, for a long time, March Air Force Base and 29 Palms would have military exercises, and these giant Black Hawk helicopters would fly directly over the property, which was a mixing and recording studios and sound stages, and it would ruin all the sound that was being recorded. And I'm pretty sure that they called in a favor, and they had that air traffic rerouted around the property. Because it was as the crow flies. You had to fly over that property. What we heard was that they pulled some strings, and Sonny had it rerouted, and they didn't fly over anymore.
But that's the thing. I mean, I guess I should probably look it up, but I just remember at one point, I think it was what later became his widow, was saying he was trying to disassociate, but they wouldn't let him. I don't even know what that means.
Well, it means, basically, to just so you have some backstory, Scientology perpetrated the largest infiltration into the United States government in its history. For years and years and years, they had operatives in multiple government agencies stealing files and destroying Scientology records that the government had on Scientology. And in 1977, in July, the FBI raided the Church of Scientology locations in Los Angeles, Hollywood, and Washington, D.C. And it was 156 agents. That's how many agents were involved in the raid. At the time, it was the largest raid of its kind. And they got 21 hours, the raid. That's how long it lasted. And they filled a 16-ton truck with documents and other items. So... And through that raid, they uncovered this infiltration that Scientology had into all these different agencies. And they infiltrated 136 government agencies, foreign embassies and consulates, as well as private organizations critical of Scientology. But So just think, if they had a whole bunch of stuff about you when you're confessing in these auditing and these counseling sessions, all these
right.
things that you've done your entire life. So it's a very, even at the time, this was this all this spy versus spy stuff was carried out by what was called the Guardian's Office. And 11 of those guys went to jail, including L. Ron Hubbard's wife, Mary Sue Hubbard. But they just rebranded that. And that is now called the Office of Special Affairs. And those are the guys that do all the same stuff they used to do, but now they have the internet, so now they do hate sites, and they do, and instead of having their individual members carry out all the dirty tricks, they hire lawyers, and then the lawyers hire private investigators.
Right.
So there's levels of, you know, denial or separation or however you want to call it. But so yeah, if you want to leave, if you're a celebrity and you want to leave, it really depends on how long you've been in, what you're worried about coming out,
right?
And also, what do you do? If
right.
you go and say they did this, they did that, they do this, yeah, I saw this, yeah, I saw that, then you can expect something to come your way.
Like, I don't have enough trolls in my life.
Right.
After this show. So, you know, it's funny about that, though, because I remember when we were, when this is Mark Headley, the book is Blown for Good. And when you were first on a decade ago, I think I told you this, that I had worked for individual radio stations, and there was kind of this, I mean, it wasn't like a hard and fast rule, but it was more like a plea from at least two program directors that I could think of. Who at different stages at different cities where I had worked, they had said, look, please don't talk about the Church of Scientology, because I'm going to get these people. They're going to come sit in my office again. They're going to have a lawyer. We're going to have to go through all of this again. Just don't do it. Just please don't do it. And so there was always this sense of intimidation in the media that if you ever did, that you were going to get crushed like a grape, right? Or they were going to demand
yeah.
equal time, or they were going to get a 3-hour thing on a weekend or something. And then,
absolutely.
And then, but then in 2010, I just got a note when you came on the show, I got two really nice emails, almost fan emails, from program directors in major cities that were carrying Coast to Coast. And they said, thank you for doing what we can't do, because
wow.
we can't do it on our show. We can't do it on our
yep.
station, but you can do it.
Yep.
And, you know, and they were like, finally, somebody that can stand up to what they were saying, what they described as bullies, these legal bullies
yep.
that were coming in, because they had all this money to spend on litigation, or threats
yeah.
of litigation anyway.
Exactly what happened. And even when I did my book, I talked to other people that had written books that never saw the light of day.
Oh, really?
And they told me, no matter what publisher you go to, they're not going to publish your book. And even if they do agree, as soon as Scientology finds out who the publisher are, they're going to say, you guys are going to get sued, and we're going to sue you. We have an unlimited litigation budget. We will spend $10 million suing you
right.
over this book.
Right.
And the one girl had already gotten her advance. She'd already been paid for the manuscript. And they said, it's done. Don't worry about it. We're good.
You keep the advance. We're not going to publish your book.
We have your manuscript. You've been paid, and it's never going to see the light of day.
Yeah.
So
ugh.
Even
well,
that was kind of what, when my book came out, that's what I had to look forward to. Like, oh boy, this is going
right.
to be a lot of fun. I might get sued into oblivion.
Well, and for whatever it's worth, I had been labeled a suppressive long before I did the show with you.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
perfect.
But that was because, I mean, I just generally talk about all different types of faith and traditions, and I wasn't singling anybody out, but it was interesting
it wasn't
that they
targeted suppression.
No, not at all. It was just like, well, here's the upside of this or whatever, and if it was in the news, I talked about it. And so, but then after that, I became sort of acutely aware, and it kind of got my Yankee up a little bit, and I was like, okay, well, I mean, I guess I should be intimidated, but I'm not, and I'm glad I never
yeah.
was. And I'm glad, I think you're, I mean, you look back on what happened and what Leah Remini did, how much of this shift in that bulletproof image that the Church of Scientology had, how much do you think you're responsible for in that shift away from that?
Well, I sort of, when I came out with my book, I sort of was, I think, like, if this guy makes it, then other people can do the same thing.
Right.
And as soon as my book came out, I did, and this is the thing, they always said, we're going to sue you, we're going to sue you, we're going to sue you. When my book came out, I didn't get sued. And on the contrary, I sold 30,000 copies.
Mm.
They could not believe the response. I was doing radio shows.
Sure.
We were doing, I flew to Germany. I spoke to the European Council of Governments on what Scientology was up to, what they were doing in their countries. And then other people who have the same story as me, then they published their book. And within, I'd say, within about 5 years, there was 25 books out from people.
Right.
And we were all telling the same exact stuff. And we were all talking about all the insanities that were going on there. And then you get a Lawrence Wright comes along, who he's got some gravitas, and he interviews a lot of the people that had written these books, and then they make that comes becomes a bestseller. Then it becomes a movie on HBO, a documentary,
right.
And then you start to see, and then the Tampa Bay Times starts digging in, and so it was just somebody just needed to hit that nail in the dam, and I want to think that my book was that nail in that dam.
I think it was.
But who knows?
I mean, there was a lot
of things happening that had to, and also you had the increasingly psychotic activities that are happening at the headquarters, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And at some point, the dam had to break.
Yeah.
So,
well, some of that had to do with Tom Cruise jumping up and down on a couch with Oprah Winfrey.
That didn't help them.
It also
didn't help them when Katie left. I think I sold 1,000 books the week Katie left.
Katie Holmes?
I say in the book how they, you know, how that whole thing was orchestrated and how,
right.
you know, we
I remember
we were
that so well.
Auditions on girls and
right.
all this other stuff. And people, and they said, that's not true. That never happened. And then you get some of these. That was another thing. I was at a party and I'm talking to a girl. And she was the one before Katie, and she was with Tom, and we were still doing auditions. And I'm talking to her. I have no idea who she is in the scheme of the overall
right.
scheme of these things. And she asked me, she said, you wrote about those auditions. And I said, yeah, yeah. She goes, what month were you doing the auditions? And I was like, that's a weird question. I was like,
right.
I don't know. It was probably like October, November, December. And she just burst into tears.
Hmm.
And then I asked them, they said, what's happened? She goes, oh, she was with Tom when they were doing those auditions.
Oh, gosh.
And I thought, oh, my goodness, I had no idea. But it was just, it was these sort of things where that wasn't helping them. All these things that were also occurring. And just the kind of mass exodus of the celebrities that started leaving and then, you get, and then really when Leah left, she went like gangbusters. And that really just made everything solid.
You know, I think she was an unlikely candidate for that. I mean, because she had at one point been a very vociferous defender and yet, when suddenly, I mean, and she of course has all this, you know, this New York swagger, even though she'd been living in California since she was 10 or something, but she's got all this sort of like Brooklyn attitude and
a
vocabulary to match.
Any nonsense.
She doesn't.
No nonsense with her.
And I think that was part of what she just came out swinging so hard. And I think it kind of made a believer out of a lot of people that, if all people, it was Leah Remini, who just, you wouldn't, I don't know. She wasn't at the top of the list, I didn't think. But, I mean, that's in the end, that's probably what, I mean, that and King of Queens is what she's going to be known best for. But I think right now it's neck and neck.
Well, I mean, she won an Emmy for the Aftermath, Scientology in the Aftermath program on A&E. And even in that program, I was learning things that I didn't know about.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it really was heartbreaking because I was on the worker end of it. We were we were working. We were, you know, punching in and doing work all day and just working to the bone. Some of the horrible stories that we heard happened to people that were members. They were paying these
right.
guys, and they were getting treated horribly.
Well, you knew a little bit about that because you even talk at the beginning of the book, and I went back to reread it, because the first copy I had is hardcover, right? That's the first
yeah.
one I got. And so here I'm reading the paperback, and that section about that guy you knew who was really wealthy, who was just getting cleaned out.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? Hundreds of thousands of dollars were going out the door for this guy.
He passed away just a few weeks ago.
Oh, did he? How did he end up in the – broke in the end? Was he broke?
Yeah, he really, really was. He didn't even do half the things. He paid for his entire wife and him to do all of Scientology's everything, like
right.
everything they had on the list. And I don't even think he got to the top. And he was still drinking the Kool-Aid until the day he passed.
Really?
And I just found out, I want to say in November, he passed away. And when I heard, I was sad. I was like, oh, man, that's really rough. I mean, he was my best friend's dad.
Right.
So
and you were in the house the day they came over to lay
yeah.
out the gold package.
That's right. Yeah. It was insanity. But another crazy thing was is that when I left in 2005, I was just like, I'm going to go my way. Those guys can go their way. I didn't set out to be this big.
Right,
you know,
to bring them down.
Renegade and do all these exposés. I just wanted to live my life. And we started seeing all these weird things and, you know, weird people around the neighborhood. And it went on for years and years. And I was always like, I think somebody's following us. I think somebody's digging through the trash. No, no, you're crazy. You're paranoid. And a lot of the ex-Scientology people that leave, they're paranoid. Because there's all these stories about all the stuff that they did.
Right.
Anyway, well, there was a guy that escaped, and he happened to be the guy that was in charge of the Office of Special Affairs.
Really?
And when he left, he had a thumb drive, and on that thumb drive was my dossier.
Oh, shut up.
And he sent it to me. And this is probably, I don't know, 2010, 2011 maybe. And in the dossier, it had everything they had been doing. They had been collecting our garbage every week. They had our phone records, who I called, how long I spoke. They had all sorts of things, all this correspondence from the Office of Special Affairs in Los Angeles to the Religious Technology Center at the headquarters. And one of the funniest things was is at that same exact time, I was in touch with people that were going to the property and doing deliveries, not Scientologists, like just people that would just supply things to the property.
Right.
That I knew from when I was at the property for so long. And they would give me updates on what people worked where. And I would leak these things on the internet, and I would talk about different things, and I would write these different things that were happening at the Ant Base as if I was there currently. And I was writing it under a pseudonym, which was Blown for Good. And that calls back to when you blow, you get
right.
recaptured. But I was Blown for Good. I was never going back. So they had a receipt that they had collected from my garbage for a wireless video transmitter. And they had somehow put the pieces together that somehow I had installed this video transmitter at the property. And I was outside the property just getting computer screens sent to me or something. I don't know how they thought this was going to work, but they had ripped the property apart, turned the place upside down, trying to find this video transmitter that I had bought because they got the receipt out of my garbage. Mm. Well, I had installed this thing somewhere in the valley in a lobby of a company for some corporate display. It had nothing to do with them, but they thought that I was they thought I was getting a live feed from their property, and that's how I was getting all this intel that I was writing up on the internet.
Plenty of paranoia to go around. We'll get back with Mark Headley coming up. I think that paranoia was best parodied in that Steve Martin, Eddie Murphy movie, Bowfinger, which obviously is a spoof on the Church of Scientology. All right, so coming up, let's get to the question of the aftermath, right? We put a pin in that. We'll readdress that coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.